Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by. You are now in conference with Mr. Bruce Davidson. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. Please go ahead, Mr. Davidson.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Bruce Davidson, Corporate Manager for Employee Assistance and Work-Life Programs here at Digital. And we want to thank you all for joining us in this evening. For those of us on the East Coast, it's a little after 8 o'clock and in other time zones, as we kind of begin to unravel the whole issue about college planning. And what we kind of nicely said was College Planning 101. And to begin to take a look at some of the pressures involved in understanding some of the college application process, and certainly the complexity of that has increased dramatically over the past couple of years. We want to help you acquire some of the information and some of perhaps some insight and understanding around some of the necessary steps in the college planning process. And our goal in providing these services and under the direction of our friends at Work Family Directions, who is our vendor in our Work Life Connections program that helps us take a look at college planning as well as our child care and elder care assistance services available to our employees and our families. Today here in Maynard in our conference room, we have three people to help us participate and unravel this very complex process. With us from Work Family Directions is Andrea Glovsky. Andrea has been with Work Family Directions as director of the educational programs and college counseling program for the past 7 years. She is a former teacher, having taught for 20 years, was head of a middle school, am I right, Andrea? A guidance counselor and is currently trustee at Lesley College. Also with us today is Peter Caruso. Peter is Senior Assistant Director for Undergraduate Admissions at Boston College. He's been in the admissions role for over 10 years and previously was in the admissions role at Stonehill College here in southeastern Massachusetts. And down at the end of the table, not that you can see the kind of table we're working with, is Mike Bartini. Michael is Director of Financial Aid Services for the College Board, and joined the College Board in 1983. Prior to that, he was Director of Financial Aid for Washington and Lee University down in Lexington, Virginia. He's a graduate of Westfield State College and Westfield, Mass. And Mike's role with the College Board is primarily focusing on the process of providing financial aid services to colleges and universities in the Northeast region. Well, today we're inundated with media, everything about colleges. There's probably more books, more guides, the top 10, top 20, top 100 list put out by every major magazine. It just seems like it has gotten more complicated since I went through this process with my own child a couple of years ago. Andrea, where does somebody begin? How does somebody begin to unravel the maze of college education and planning?
Well, you know, Bruce, it's really interesting because we find that most parents fall into two categories. They're either the ones who worry way too soon or the ones who worry way too late. But there are things you can do all along the spectrum so you don't have to be in those categories. As early as freshman and sophomore year, and I don't know how many out there are freshmen and sophomores, but you can really even start thinking about course selection. You can think about making sure you take the most competitive courses you could possibly do well in. You don't take an advanced course unless you know you can be successful in an advanced course. But you also don't take too many of the extras that really belong in the college level. If you fill your courses with photography and psychology 101 and marketing and forget all the important English, math, sciences, and languages that colleges are looking for, you're really selling yourself short and leaving yourself out of the more competitive college process. We also suggest that you take some time to think about careers, and one of the best ways to learn about what you'd like to do with your life is to actually shadow adults in the real world. And I suggest you shadow young adults as opposed to adults the age of your folks, because they're really a lot closer to the college process and might tell you some of the trials and tribulations it took to become an engineer or to become a physical therapist. If you spend a day with someone who's 30 years old, they remember what it was like to get there. Another thing you can do very early on in the process and all the way through all 4 years is find yourself exploring college campuses. I think it's really important that you do it informally even before you begin the formal process. I suggest to many, many families, when you're on the road and going to stop for lunch somewhere, do yourself a favor. Don't stop at McDonald's or Burger King or Pizza Hut or whatever is on the highway. Pull off and visit a college campus. Many college campuses actually have Burger King, Pizza Huts, and all of those things on their campus. You can eat whatever, but colleges welcome visitors on their campus, and it's great fun. You get to know more about the school. Kids are delighted to tell you all about BC and their latest victories or defeats or whatever college you're visiting. They love to be able to tell you. They're very proud. They'll tell you all about the social life. They'll tell you how bad the food is, or how good the food is. And their bulletin boards will tell you everything about whether the school is, whether everybody leaves all weekend long. If you look at the bulletin board and everybody's looking for a ride Friday afternoon, you know nobody's there all weekend. So informal visits really begin to give you a feeling of what a college campus is like. And so I think those are good things to begin that whole process with. Fill in some of those holes with your good course selection. Get your ideas for career by following young adults and really start to look at campuses. Those are things you can watch for all 4 years in the process, and that's how you begin. And that's a good way to pursue having a full planning process underway.
So you're even suggesting that somebody as early as freshman or sophomore year start to explore, poke at the whole notion of college and visiting
colleges? Absolutely, because what happens is the panic strikes the student their senior year, this time of the year, wow, I haven't even been on a college campus. Or, gee, I don't have the vaguest idea what I want to major in. I haven't even thought about it. Or I never took 2 years of a foreign language. What do I do now? And so if you leave those things to your senior year, sometimes you can be very frustrated. So tend to some of these things as you go. If you are a senior, it's not too late to do many of the things that we talk about. Visiting college campuses can't be quite so informal. I would suggest more formal visits. You cannot go back and undo course selection, but you can think about career-wise what you'd like to do with what you have chosen. I do suggest, though, that you do pursue some sort of volunteerism. You're never too late for that. I've noticed every college, and Pete, you might suggest that that's true at your school, assumes that kids do some kind of community service or volunteer work now, where 20 years ago it was the thing to do, now it's assumed.
Well, particularly when you look at the institutional mission of the university, and BC being a Jesuit institution, and in its mission, most students are doing community service. About anywhere from 50 to 75% are doing some type of community service. It's even woven into the fabric of the curriculum at BC. So that's going to be important. In fact, by design, we look at it as part of the application process.
So you would look at it as a whole if someone didn't have it?
I would say so. It's not going to take precedence over the transcript and the hierarchy of what we look at, but certainly I think to determine if a student is a good fit for the institution and if they're going to be happiest at the institution, not that it's mandated, but I think most students, and again, it depends upon the institution, are engaged in some type of community service.
Yeah, but are you looking for sustained community activity? Or, I mean, does it crop up here? We have a parent whose child is senior year and there's nothing on that resume. Is it too late?
I think what we try to emphasize, regardless of the activity, is depth. And I think if a student has been a founding member of the Safe Rides campaign or Students Against Drunk Driving or has done some type of work for Amnesty International or Habitat for Humanity, I think we prefer that we'd see some consistency over the past 4 years, as opposed to someone who decides to throw themselves into all sorts of projects, whether it's community service or other aspects.
You're not too fond of joiners, You're not too fond of joiners, the students who sign up junior year for 25 clubs, and they sign up for every club on campus, and their resume looks like 1 year French club, 1 year chess club, 1 year. And there was a time when colleges looked at the children who had the broadest number or the greatest number of activities.
I think versatility is important, but I think the emphasis at some institutions is on depth.
Yeah. We're seeing that more and more.
Sustained.
Sustained. Joiners for joiner's sake really don't show anything.
Well, another underlying issue is time management. Because when you look at transition issues to college and the independence factor, particularly if you're going to be part of the residential community, when you look at co-curricular activities, one of the underlying aspects is emphasizing time management. If a student can combine the rigors of academics with just the right balance, that's another reason to look at depth of activity.
I want to take us back for a second, because just a second ago we were talking about trying to get through the visits. So let's assume, based on certainly numbers of people who've dialed in tonight, that here they are sitting in their senior year. They've done some summer visits. They've been out. They looked at some things in January, in the springtime, during the junior year, and they're sitting there with a kitchen table filled with course school catalogs and applications, and they're looking at 20 schools, and they've got to whittle it down to a manageable number, and they're dealing with a typical teenager who is not so sure what they want to do, where they want to focus, and where they want to go to school, and are struggling in their senior year of school. How does that parent, or how does anybody help the child kind of narrow their thinking down so that they can at least apply to a manageable batch of schools, some of which they may even be interested in going to?
That's a really tough question. It's interesting you ask it, but you have to think about the important factors that are specific to you. You have to assess your family, your personal needs, where you want to be, how large a school you want to be at. If you started to look at schools, you may already know you don't want to be on a campus with, like Purdue University, with 40, 50,000 students on that campus. That may not feel very good to you. On the other hand, you may not want to be at a Stonehill College, which has how many students?
1,900.
And there are some schools, on a good day, and there are some schools like Elmira in New York, I think, that have 950 students. So, I mean, you may say, my goodness, my high school is bigger than 950 students. How could I go to a school that size? So looking at the size of a school can really help you cross schools out of a list, because you can't be comfortable. Looking at location of a school, because you may not want to be in a city. You just may not be comfortable in downtown Manhattan. It may not feel good to you. And yet someone else may find out that they don't really want to be, 45 miles from the nearest city. And they say, I can't handle that. And they may want to be in a city. So some of the schools self-select for that reason alone. The other thing is, parents say to me, well, I really have to have my child within 3 hours distance of the house, and that's the rule. Or the student feels they have to be within 3 hours. I got to get home every weekend. Well, I've always said to children, as I've said to my own children, 3 hours can be 3 hours lots of ways. So you can pick a school and you say that's in upper state New York. It could take you a lot longer to drive to than getting on a plane today in many of the inexpensive flights in the small airlines that take you 2 hours and 15 minutes. It used to take my son 2 hours to drive home and my daughter two hours to fly home. So they were equal distant from home. And so you look at that and say, how do I weigh that? Well, the distant school may cost a lot less than the close-by school, so that the airfare balances out. So be careful you don't select too narrowly just because you want to be 2 hours away. So distance can be a really important factor. Other things, quickly, to look at what the courses are in the school, what they have to offer. Don't shut yourself down by picking too narrow a major and say, whoops, after a year I don't want to be at that school anymore. Make sure it has enough breadth to it so that if you change your mind, which 80% of all children do by junior year, change your mind, then you've got something else to take. Also, cultural diversity on campus can be really important to you. So look at all of those things and put them on the table and say, which of these 20 things feel right to me? And go to the internet and look at these schools on the internet. Look at their catalogs. You can't visit them all, but that's a good way to start. There's lots more we'll say about that. There's testing factors and other things.
Well,
and money, and Mike's going to help us with some of that.
And for those of us, those of you that perhaps have just joined us today, in our conference room, we have Mike Bertini from the College Board and Director of Financial Aid. We have Peter Caruso, who's a Senior Assistant Director of Undergraduate Admissions at Boston College, and Andrea Glovsky, who's with Work Family Directions here in Boston and is responsible for their college counseling section in their program and provide services to digital. I want to turn to Pete and begin to kind of take a look at the testing arrays. I mean, it's becoming like alphabet soup, whether it's PSATs, SATs, ACTs. Now we have the SAT2,
right,
which is, you know, it gets into the new, the better, the best.
Believe it or not, Bruce, there were more.
There are more letters. There's more letters and more numbers. How does a parent help support the child kind of sorting out where do you begin as this testing comes? And I've got more questions about that in terms of test preps and so forth. But what ages do the parents need to pay attention to when these tests need to be taken,
right,
and the sequence of events, and do you take them more than once, twice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's next to the financial aid question, it's probably the most commonly asked question that I get, and there's always a bit of anxiety that's behind the question. And one of the things that I always try to tell parents is that, and students, is to try to gain some perspective, because SATs are not going to stand alone. That colleges differ, but most institutions will look at the SAT in a SAT1 in a secondary fashion as opposed to the high school transcript. Most colleges across the country, when they look at standardized test scores, will either require a student to submit the SAT1 or the ACT, which is predominantly found not so much in the Northeast but in the Midwest. And at Boston College, as we've had such a national draw, we're starting to see more and more students take the ACT. In terms of the SAT1, Bruce, and when we advise students to take it, most students will begin taking the SAT1 in March, and we see a lot of students who are submitting, particularly for early action. We'll talk more about early action later on in the program. But most students are submitting at least two sets of scores for early action, so they're taking the SAT one in one of the spring dates, whether it's March, April, May, or June. And then we usually ask the student to submit an October SAT1 date. And we always encourage students to take the SAT1 more than once. I think most colleges would sort of subscribe to that.
So we're talking junior and senior.
Correct. So first admission would be during the junior year, and then over the summer, once they get their scores back, they can begin to sort of see where they stand. And sometimes the anxiety is reduced, in some cases, the second time they take the test. So with that in mind, and using BC and Stonewall as specific examples of this, we would take the two best scores regardless of how many times the student took the test. So if the best verbal happened to be in May and the best math happened to be in November, those are the two scores that we will look at. Now, I can say that's going to be happening universally, and I think, as you'll find out throughout the evening, one of the things we'll emphasize is check with the institution and what is their testing philosophy. One of the things that I think is important to stress is that most colleges do not have minimum entrance requirements for the SAT. This varies from school to school, but usually institutions look at a range. BC, for example, the middle 50% of last year's class scored between a 1210 and 1340 on the SAT1. So we had 25% of our students who were below 1210 and 25% were above 1340. And in addition to the SAT1, most colleges are going to ask students to submit three SAT2 subject tests, which is important to stress because if a student usually has an exemplary transcript and moderate SAT1 scores, in some cases, the SAT2 subject tests may be higher. So we look at that as another vehicle for which to make a decision to admit the student.
When should those achievement tests be taken?
Oh, well, you used the word achievement, by the way.
They used
most
to be
now
SAT2. Remember
those as achievement tests.
Well, you know, I'm dating myself.
Yeah,
but
okay.
You have to remember only the top 125 schools in the country. Am I correct, Mike? Use the SAT2. So, you're talking about a selective group of schools use SAT2s.
And some moderately selectives will actually encourage them.
And they use it for placement purposes.
Right. So that's a good point, Andrea. Some schools, BC included, will use it for placement, particularly in English and in foreign language, but we also use it for admission as another testing vehicle.
Well, but we were talking about this before the program started. Let's say the child finishes their biology program in the sophomore year.
Right.
is not planning to take biology again in their junior or senior year, even on a college advanced placement basis. Mm-hmm. Should they take that SAT two-subject test in their sophomore year at the end when they finish the course, same with chemistry and any of the others? I mean, is it advisable to take it closer to completing the course or waiting until a junior or senior?
Absolutely.
Maybe it's a question in the obvious.
Oh, but. Absolutely. I think if you don't take it the minute you finish it, the loss, that as an old school teacher, the loss of learning is amazing. So if you take biology your senior year and haven't taken it since your junior year or your sophomore year, unless you really spend extensive amount of time prepping for it, you're going to have tremendous loss. So take it when you finish it, and that's a teacher's head trying to meet the needs of kids.
Bruce, I also think, though, that most students who take the SAT, too, and we encourage this, because we require one in writing, one in mathematics, and one of the student's choice, and the one of the student's choice should be in an area that they're thinking of going into. That seems to make the most sense, and that's because that's another way that we're going to look at it in terms of admission. If they're going into an area of American history or physics or mathematics, they may want to take math, the math SAT too. So it should be emphasized that if they're going to be taking an SAT too, they should really lean towards the subject matter that they may be studying on a post-secondary matter basis.
That makes sense. Before we get off the subject of testing, which is a major anxiety producing area for many kids and parents. There's a proliferation of software programs, written tests. We've got the paid courses, whether it's the Kaplan's or whatever,
Princeton Reviews. Huntington Learning Center.
We can go on and on.
We don't want to get in trouble with all the
competition. No, I don't want to do that either. What makes sense? I mean, is it worth the investment?
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask about this because I'm not a big advocate for test prep, particularly where a family is going to have to shell out more money, because this process is expensive enough as it is on all levels. But I think, and Andrew could probably speak more about the software aspects available, but I think because, philosophically speaking, since it's not a standalone aspect, and regardless of how competitive the SAT is, if the other aspects, particularly in the other, with the transcript and the course selection, as Andrew talked about before, if that's not in place, which for most colleges is a priority, it's actually going to raise more issues, because you may look at a student who has a very high SAT, but if it's not consistent with their course selection and their high school performance, given the philosophy of most institutions, it probably isn't going to serve them as well as they would have hoped.
I'm going to give a non-college response
okay.
to that. Is that okay?
That's fine, sure.
Our philosophy at Work Family Directions is if a student wants to improve their SATs mm-hmm. and is willing to make a time commitment, then there is nothing wrong with working to study for the SATs, especially when you're in competition with over 50% of the kids in this country are getting help of mm-hmm. some sort. Mm-hmm. Why shouldn't you do something? Now, what you do may not be take a $900 course, because mm-hmm. even though they might guarantee it, they may not get you what you want except a lot of anxiety, and mm-hmm. I've seen that happen. But if you are committed, there is wonderful software. There's also a book that the College Board puts out that we recommend to every single student who takes the SAT called 10 Real SATs. There are 10 previous SATs that people have mm-hmm. taken. You can take those tests and actually practice. Mm-hmm. If you're committed and you practice, you can raise your scores because of familiarity and comfort level. And that really is the whole issue. Do you want to commit yourself to improving your scores, and are you willing to take the time? Then use Princeton Review software or Sylvan software or one-on-one in the SAT, which is a terrific one the College Board has, because it has a little timer guy in it, and he tells you how long you're spending on a question. And that really helps, because you might spend, you know, 7 whole minutes on a reading comprehension question, and you go, oh, I can't do that anymore. I better learn to do that section faster. So there are some really good programs out there. They're worth the investment. They're worth the time. If the student wants to. If dad come home and say, I just bought this for you, now I want you to spend 20 minutes a night for the next 10 weeks, it isn't going to work. So it's up to the student.
And I couldn't agree with you more about that. I guess my whole point is just when I'm listening to students and I'm listening to parents get so hung up on cutoffs, and if I get a 1300, it's going to put me over the top. And that's where the concern comes into play. It has to be in the context of the rest of the applicants.
Mike, I know you're on the finance side, but I mean, you're hanging around the conference board. I'm sure the college board, you got something to say about this.
I tend to agree with Andrea. It doesn't make any difference what you do as long as you do it. If you want to increase your scores, put yourself in some type of structured curriculum where you're going to be able to pick up your comprehension, to pick up better math skills. And don't forget the simple test-taking skills, because in some cases, students may not be familiar with that type of a format. So, again, those are the things that I recommend, and I tend to agree with Andrea that you don't have to spend a lot of money to do these things either.
So the notion of my kid doesn't test well,
right,
maybe really take a few of these tests, take the 10 sample ones, and get over some of the phobia and
right,
get familiar with the format.
I mean, how often do you do analogies in your daily life, Bruce? I mean, you don't sit down and do analogies because you're not comfortable. You don't need to. But if you do 10 or 12 tests with analogies in them, suddenly they're more comfortable and they're not such a big deal, and they're you know, they feel okay. It's the fact you're not familiar with them. And if you walk in cold, you're not going to be able to do very well in them.
You just brought back my memories of the Miller's analogy. It used to be a graduate
requirement. Well, guess what? The SAT has a big chunk of analogies in it, and it's not something any of us look back fondly on. But guess what? The realities of SATs. Why not practice them? We don't use them. You might as well practice that skill. It's a real skill. So that's my philosophy, and colleges may prefer that no one do any prep work, but the reality
do. You're missing my point. I guess I agree with you in terms of the not-for-profit aspect of it. I guess my whole point is that I just see it.
Big business.
Right, but at the same time, I also see it just being overemphasized in the selection process, that they're putting that at the forefront when it is important. And I'm not trying to undermine its importance, but I'm also trying to emphasize that transcripts for most schools are going to be a priority. So,
but given a choice between volunteering for an organization and spending, the 5 hours a week doing the extracurricular volunteerism versus fighting with your kid to study for the SATs, where should they put their time?
Well, that's another issue entirely, because that's a point well taken. Because I mean, if we emphasize,
that's a good point, Bruce. You're really putting out
the but if we emphasize the fact that objective criteria is going to be a priority, then a student probably has to look at prepping in some fashion. But at the same time, that goes back to Andrea's earlier point about course selection, about early intervention, about curriculum. But hopefully it's not going to get to that level where a student has to make that choice where they're putting their time into volunteerism or having to choose 5 hours of test prep. I see your point, but I think getting back to Andrea's earlier point in the beginning of this program, where I think early awareness, that sort of emphasizes Andrea's point of early awareness.
Well, kind of fast-forwarding a little bit, because clearly in an hour and a half we're not going to touch upon every bit and every aspect of college planning. But as you said, of the two top questions you're asked, it's one is testing and one is money. And clearly the whole issue of whittling down the schools and worrying about how you're going to pay for schools is on a lot of people's minds. And Mike, maybe you can help us kind of unravel the mystique here. And, you know, is it the federal programs? Is it the FAFSA? Or it's the profile? It's the timing? Can you kind of help us out here and maybe give us a financial 101? Keeping in mind that in January we're hoping to do a dedicated program on the financial aspects of college planning and get into some details about some of these programs and filling out the applications, but maybe you can give us a good overview here.
The first thing I want to focus on, and certainly we've already done that tonight, the college going process has a lot of tension in it. Factor in financial aid, and all of a sudden people are probably about ready to jump off the side of the table. But I think there's some things that you can do that can help you as a family better understand how the process works, how you fit into the process, and what your expectations should be. The first piece of information that I think is particularly important are those pieces of information that are put out by institutions. You're receiving admissions information, and every admissions piece that I've read has something in it about financial aid. Please read it. because that particular information will talk to you about some important factors, such as the forms required and or the deadlines that you have to comply with in order to meet their particular deadlines for financial aid. This can get complicated in the sense that you're applying to a half a dozen schools or more, and each one has a different deadline date. Build yourself a simple chart so you can keep track of them. And I say always lead to the ones with the earliest deadlines. So if College A happens to have a deadline in February, but College C happens to have a deadline in January, certainly meet the January deadlines first. Some common forms that you're going to come into contact with. The first one is the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, or better known as the FAFSA. That's the application that anybody who wants to apply for federal funds must complete.
It's blue this year, right?
It is blue this year. We
the pink color wasn't.
No. If you've got a pink one. Or a green one, throw it away. It's not going to work.
And remember that there are some of you out there who may have sons and daughters who are 2 and 3 years away from going to college, and primarily we're focusing on those who will be going to college next fall. But this information should be relevant for that point as well. So there's the FAFSA. The FAFSA is now available. It's arriving at high schools, and so you can pick it up. And remember what I said about college deadlines. Recognize who has the first college deadline. But one thing for certain is with the FAFSA, you cannot send it in until January 1st. So you can get the form, you can make yourself familiar with it, you can look at the questions, particularly the income and asset questions, and become familiar with the data that you're going to need to collect. Now, there are going to be some cases when families are going to require that they have to estimate the data that needs to go on the form. If you've got a deadline in January and February, and you're barely, or at least if you're like me, barely getting your income tax information together, you're going to have to do some estimating. But I suspect from your pay stubs and from the data that you receive from your employer, you can do that. Again, the important factor here is not whether the data is absolutely accurate. You want to be as accurate as you possibly can, but you don't want to miss that deadline. So the first application that we talk about is the FAFSA. Another application that we will talk a bit about is the one called the CSS Financial Aid Profile. Recognize here that the profile is not required by all institutions, but only some institutions. How are you going to find out what institutions require what forms? Remember that admissions material that is sent to you will list all the requirements for applying for financial aid. And there are some institutions who also have their own institutional applications. Sometimes they bundle them with the admissions application, and other times they're separate. But nonetheless, they will make them available to students, and they too have deadlines. You can pick up the FAFSA, the profile information at your high school guidance office or from the colleges that you're dealing with. Both forms are available now. In a little bit, we're going to talk about early decision, and some of the early decision candidates need to be moving a little bit quicker than the standard applicants. That's, I think, the main focus.
A lot of people need to know about the internet online material. If you try www.collegeboard.org, you will get a lot of information about financial aid. You can also use the U.S. Department of Education site to get information on financial aid. You can find the FAFSA online now or in a couple of weeks, and you can also find a lot of information about it. So if you use the internet, you can really get a lot of quick access to financial aid. There's tons out there. You just have to be careful that you don't pay for anything, because everything that's out there is free. And if you have to pay for it, then be suspect. Is that a good piece of advice?
I would agree with Andrea. If today's medium is turning quickly from paper to electronic measures,
right,
and most everybody has information available on the World Wide Web. One of the nice features about a web application, whether it be for the FAFSA or the profile form, is that many of them have built-in edits, so that as you complete the questions, and go from section to section, there are edits built in to help you make sure that you did not make mistakes. So there, one of the ways you can get information about financial aid on the World Wide Web is just to do a search on financial aid, and you'll find yourself with a variety of opportunities above and beyond the application process.
And of course, if you're going to search, you'll use AltaVista.
You can also call the 1-800-635-0606 and talk to Work Family Directions Counselor, and we would help you with your questions as well. So we help with the entire college process, just to remind you that we are available.
So the important part I think I'm trying to stress right now is that you will only increase the tension of this process if you delay putting together a plan to complete your forms by the deadline stated by each institution. So hopefully that is come through clear.
Well, that's a good start, and I think, you know, as we look at doing this program early in January, it'll give us an opportunity to really, I think, drill down into some of the questions that the forms ask, to get into issues around equity and so forth. But I would imagine that there's also of advice out there about sheltering money and hiding money and what positions a family in terms of savings and whether the child should show a lot of savings or not. And it may be too late for those kids who are perhaps juniors and seniors. But is there any quick tips around those in the freshman, sophomore in terms of doing some quick financial planning now? Andrea's telling me I'm not being fair. But.
Actually, there are. There is plenty of information out there about financial aid and what families can do in order to save for college. One of the responsibilities a family has is to save for college, and there are lots of different vehicles out there to help you do that. The right one for you, of course, takes a little bit of searching. So if you have someone who you work with your investments, or if you do have some savvy of your own and you want to read different publications, going to your local library is another good source of just information about how to position yourself so that you have the most money available when that son or daughter heads off to college.
Something that most parents don't realize, people are very worried about having assets, Mike, and I have learned through the years by learning a lot about the free application for federal student aid, is it's really not asset driven, that it's okay to have assets. You don't get terribly penalized for having assets. The system is much more driven by your income than by your assets, because you're allowed to protect a piece of your assets, and then only about less than 6% goes toward college every year. And I think people think, if I put money in the bank, I'll never get financial aid, and that's not true.
I agree. Just like other consumer products, most of us pay them out of current cash, and in the financial aid process, your income is what drives the process. On the other hand, if you have an extraordinary amount of assets, they will certainly factor in there to a fairly high degree.
But I'm talking about most families.
But most families have assets reflective of their income. So if you're a middle-income family, you're likely to have a reasonable size of assets, and therefore it's not going to steer the direction of your family contribution. If you're interested in finding out how these formulas work and or learn more about the formulas, again, the World Wide Web is a good location. We at the College Board have the Federal Methodology Worksheet online. Sallie Mae is another vendor who has the...
And we also provide it at WFD, free to you from digital. So there are lots of ways to get it, and don't be afraid to ask for it.
So with WFD, they actually will get a form that they can fill out, and you'll run it through the process.
Right, absolutely.
And do a preliminary analysis.
Right. That's available to them free by calling the 800 number.
Now, we're talking about your expected family contribution and what it is that you're going to have to pay for college. Recognize, of course, that the final say is always with the college that you're applying to. And so doing these estimates will put you in a range probably that will give you some sense of where your responsibility is going to be. But it's not something that you should take to the bank, as they say.
That's a good point.
Before we get too bogged down with all the anxiety and nervousness over the money issues, which certainly is important, right now probably the greatest endeavor for the seniors is focusing on the whole issue of early admissions, early action, rolling admissions, and so forth. And can you kind of help us with some of the myths and misconceptions about that? Is it an advantage or disadvantage?
Well, I think when you look at trends in admissions, and certainly the past 3 or 4 years in conversations that I've had with counselors, more and more students, talking to guidance counselors, more and more students are applying either early action or early decision. And in conversations I had last week with some counselors out in San Francisco where I was at a conference, anywhere from 20 to 35% of students within their school systems are applying early action or early decision, which obviously means more work for them. But I think it's becoming more prevalent at more selective institutions. But there seems to be confusion in conversations that I have with students and parents about the language. And when you look at early decision versus early action, I think it's important to emphasize to our listeners that early decision generally means that it's binding, that if a student chooses to apply to an institution early decision, they can apply to other colleges regular decision, but if they're accepted to this institution early, that they're actually going to be withdrawing their applications and committing to that school.
Now, I assume you can apply to only one college early decision.
Correct.
That's correct.
Correct.
I just want you to confirm that, because I get that question.
And Andrew, that's a really good question, because I think, from an ethical standpoint, if a student applies to two colleges early decision, if given the fact that they're going to be admitted to both those schools.
It's a binding contract.
Well, what do you mean by binding contracts? I mean, are you obligated to pay a year's worth of tuition?
Yes. In fact, legally, you should be. The contract says, I will attend and pay for school, in essence.
Mm-hmm.
Very few colleges actually hold you to that. Every now and then you do hear a story about a school coming back after a child who has pulled out of early decision. We've heard several legal cases about it. It is actually a legally binding contract, mm-hmm. early decision mm-hmm. is, and there are a couple of loopholes. One is, I think, is financial aid is the reason.
Well, that's the one thing, and we talked about this before the program. Usually it's under the condition when a student is admitted early decision that the institution will meet the full need. And in cases where full need is not met, or if the financial aid situation cannot be worked out, then a student obviously has a recourse to seek another institution.
But that's really the only reason, right. That and health issues are the only real issues.
Right, and I think that's why maybe a more flexible route would be early action, which is the other aspect. And early action, what we have at Boston College, is simply an early notification program. And I'd say roughly 20 to 22% of our students annually apply early action. Under early action, you can apply to other institutions that offer similar non-binding early action programs. You can obviously apply to other institutions' regular decision if you are accepted, and Boston College typically notifies students right before the Christmas holiday. And then you have until what is known as the candidate's reply date, which is May 1st. So students who are admitted in December under the early action, which is non-binding, still can apply to regular decision institutions and have until May 1.
Can they apply to an early decision school as well?
That's a really good question, and I think, looking at it from my perspective, we would prefer that they didn't. I think,
because I get high school students ask me that. Well, I have an early decision, but I also have an early action I might like to mm-hmm. apply to.
I mean, technically, they're not in conflict. I think we would like to see them focus on that one school and then see what happens during the regular decision process, but certainly we have no way of knowing if a student is applying to other schools early decision.
That's really helpful, Peter, thanks.
Bruce, you also had a question about regarding, is it more selective, is it an advantage? And I think, and I know this will be reoccurring tonight, you really have to go from institution to institution. Some schools have a more lenient policy when it comes to early decision or early action. Other institutions, and I'll include Boston College in this, we actually are more competitive at early action as opposed to regular decision for two reasons. Number one, since we have yet to look at 78% of our applicants, we tend to be more conservative. And collectively, people who apply early are stronger. And we've noticed that particularly when you look at objective criteria, most students who apply early are stronger at BC. So at BC, it's more selective. At some schools, it may be a little bit more lenient. So I think just to advise our listeners that they really have to go from institution to institution to find out what their early policy is.
But what I'm hearing between you and Andrea is that if anybody's considering to do early decision,
which is the binding,
which is the real binding,
right.
They need to have some you know, they need to be up in the 95% surety level that that's the school that they want to attend.
Right.
I'm saying 99% surety. They have to know that this is where they want to be.
And that goes back to Andrea's point about looking at schools and really investigating the school both on what I call the unscientific level. You know, Andrea talked about going into the cafeteria, and that is so true in terms of authenticity, but also really investigating the institution from an institutional philosophy level. Anyone who doesn't take the early decision process seriously probably is better off doing early action or regular decision.
That concludes side one of this presentation. Please fast forward the tape and turn it over.